This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter, in which John Connor, novelist and editorial writer of one of London's daily newspapers, gives his comments on interesting happenings of the week. This is John Connor from London.
I've just had a most delightful morning watching the wheels go round. Very small wheels.
I've been to the Model Engineering Exhibition, which is in the middle of a 10 days run here in London. I'm a clumsy, ham-handed sort of person with very little mechanical bent. But I grew up in the same house as a cousin of mine, who nowadays is an ingenious and skilled engineer. And although he's several years younger than I am, I developed a whacking big inferiority complex, so far as he was concerned, about simple handyman jobs about the house. I became his unskilled stooge, standing around holding the box of tools and passing up the appropriate wrench or screwdriver whenever it was needed. But I've always had a forlorn passion for models. I used to like making them. I love looking at them. Model ocean liners, for example, in the big shipping company's windows. There are several of the big company's offices in Cockspur Street, which leads out of Trafalgar Square. And in all the years I've lived and worked in London, I can't tell you how often I've found excuses to amble up Cockspur Street and linger in front of the Queen Mary, in perfect miniature, from stem to stern about the length of my desk. I know it's a childish affectation, but if I may judge by the Model Engineering Exhibition, it's one which I seem to share with about half the male population of London. School holidays are in full swing here at present, so I imagine every boy within reach of London has found his way to the exhibition hall. I got there 20 minutes after it opened this morning, and it was crammed with people. I went there last Saturday to reconnoitre, as it were, and get in if it were reasonably empty. And there was a queue stretching right round the block, waiting in pouring rain. If you like small-scale models, what an enchanting show it is. I suppose millions of us do contain this rather ingenuous, rather pathetic streak of immaturity in us all our lives, this love of toys. I know I've seen a score of distinguished and gallant generals spending hours poring over a model battlefield, adjusting toy tanks, moving platoons of tiny soldiers up into position, with the most self-absorbed, delicious gusto. But I was impressed at this exhibition with its quite firm and obviously quite undeliberate emphasis on the peaceful, constructive sides of human activities. There were railway engines and paddle steamers and passenger aircraft. There was one delicious exhibit, which was a whole streetcar system with traffic signals and a panel of control switches and beautiful little repair sheds. There were model churches and model housing lots, but of engines of war, surprisingly few. Perhaps the young and the ever young in heart have had their basin full of war like everybody else. Having lost my heart to a model workshop, which showed you how to assemble a power launch from the first blueprint to the completed craft, gleaming in polish and paint, and ready to win every regatta prize, then I strayed over to a small railway track about 50 yards long. Here there was a little locomotive with a coal fender astern of it and 8 flat freight trucks. This exhibit completely captivated me because it had a small station, a depot, where you could buy tickets and board the train for a ride. I think you had to be 10 years old or under to get aboard. The queue was long and patient. A full payload seemed to be 9 little boys and the driver, an amiable young man, who from time to time gave the engine a small shovelful of coal and tooted the whistle. I think it's established that British people are very hobby-minded. And of course, model engineering is only a hobby for a very specialist minority. Now, I have a suspicion that it's a minority that will grow in years to come. We have, however, one national pastime which is far more than a hobby. That's football, of which the 1948-49 season opened last Saturday. I know people talk about cricket being the national game of the British, but lovely and lovable though cricket is, it's not really our national game. Football is, and football to millions of British people is much more than a game.
It's difficult to explain. I fancy it's more than a bit difficult to justify. But the passion that's in us for football is very deep-rooted and very persistent. Football, the man called association or soccer, which is played by teams of 11 on either side and with a round ball. This kind of football is most of the colour, the art, the worship and the faith in human dignity and human achievement that millions of men possess who live in our industrial cities. You may say that life for them must be warped and stunted. Social reformers have been saying that for 100 years. You may say it's an anodyne against the harsh conditions of proletarian existence. Social reformers have been saying that too. What they haven't got round to explaining is why, now that opportunities are widening all the time for the cultural use of leisure, why millions still stick to football. In fact, football's not losing its appeal, it's increasing it. The anthropologists and the psychologists are beginning to shuffle around this question of football. I think they'll take great pains in elucidating and annotating the blissfully obvious. And after years of study, they'll publish huge learned books demonstrating that millions of British men like watching football matches on Saturday afternoons, which a poor chump of a novelist like myself could have told them years ago. Football offers a release to many complex and much frustrated emotions and instincts in its countless supporters and fans. First of all, it's every man's game. We've all played it since we could remember, round the street corners, on the waste patch, in the schoolyard, out on the recreation ground. Its principles and its rules are engraved on all our memories when they are most pliable. Its skill and its finesse are there for us to learn and to study. And the people who do become extremely proficient and highly paid footballers are chaps like ourselves, from the same bench at the same school, from the house 3 doors down the street. Great fame at football doesn't take a lad out of the world in which he was born. He doesn't, like a man who succeeds in business or in politics, go up among what the Scots call the high hedians, the bosses, with foreign office hats and suits made to measure and la-di-da voices. And he doesn't, like a movie star, go into a mad dream world. He keeps his feet on the ground because he earns his keep and his fame by them, and he remains, however illustrious his career, one of his own folk. When his playing days are done, he's quite apt to go back to the street or the village in which he was born, and there fulfill, modestly and quietly, the modest dream of millions of humble folk. He keeps a pub, or he opens a shop, or a little cycle repair business. And that quality, that 2 feet on the earth quality, is one which British people like very much indeed. Football's got so much else besides. For example, it's a release of power. If you're little and ill-paid and browbeaten, and a good many men are in this tough world, there's little harm and a good deal of satisfaction in standing on a windswept terrace in company with 70,000 of your fellows and shouting, tackle him, whenever you and about 35,000 around you feel like it. Few of us have a chance to bellow at anybody in our workaday lives. So why shouldn't we bellow encouragement or abuse at 11 athletic young men once a week? But most of all, in our secret hearts, football is art and poetry. It's a release into a world of form and swift, graceful, disciplined movement. It's a gateway, its own kind of gateway, I'll admit, into the same world as that of Beethoven's symphonies, of the Swan Lake Ballet, of King Lear. More than 1 million people on a Saturday afternoon passed through the turnstiles to watch the first big professional games this year. It's risky to generalize about the motives of 1 million men, but I think that Saturday after Saturday, every autumn and every winter, millions of people who file away into the raw dusk, lighting their pipes and turning up their coat collars as the street lamps come on, have been sharing in something not altogether tawdry or artificial. For 90 minutes or so, they've been citizens of that far, fine country where every man is free and every man is a king. I believe that some of our hostile critics sometimes fasten on our passion for football as one sign of our national decadence. And one of the odder experiences of this generation of British people has been to find
how ferociously criticized we are. Usually rather more for what we think are virtues than for what we think are our failings. It's something of a welcome moment, therefore, when someone praises us. And when he praises us, not just for being brave in 1940, but for working hard in 1948, we feel inclined to say thank you. Monsieur Paul Renault, the new French finance minister, when he was broadcasting to his own people the other day, explaining his policy, made some remarkable observations about Britain. He gave us high praise for being, as he said, since the day of victory, imbued with one idea, export or die. And he spoke very directly to French peasants, telling them in no uncertain terms, not merely that they'd got to work harder, but that they'd got to increase their productivity. And then he gave some figures. He said that whereas the work of one French peasant worker now feeds five people, an American agricultural worker feeds 13, and a British agricultural worker feeds 17. In the newspaper on which I work, we were very interested in these figures, and we asked various official organizations, like the Ministry of Agriculture and the National Farmers Union and the Agricultural Workers Union, what they thought were the reasons for Britain's really outstanding lead. They all agreed that Monsieur Renault's figures were probably right. And they all said, that lead is due to mechanization. And one or two of them quoted impressive statistics about the number of tractors and mechanical harvesters that are now in use on British farms. Farming in Britain, they said, which used to be one of the most neglected and backward of industries, has modernized itself, and now it's far ahead of a whole lot of our industries. I saw a practical example of this last weekend, when my wife and I were staying with some friends in Buckinghamshire, about 40 miles from London. And on Sunday afternoon, we and their two small daughters went for a stroll just around milking time. We'd gone across a couple of orchards, and we were on a path crossing a stretch of pasture land. A jeep suddenly pulled up in this field beside a thin metal movable shed. Two handsome Guernsey cows trotted over to the shed. We watched while the young farmer rolled back sliding doors and revealed the shed in three compartments, engine house, milking shed, and dairy. He switched the small petrol engine on. To each cow's udder, he adjusted a curious apparatus, looking like a dry iron curler in a fashionable hairdresser's. Pipes from this machine, which was a mechanical milker, led to a central can. The whole process was as smooth, as technically efficient, as a piece of motion study conveyor belt working in a factory. The young farmer, who was a demobilized officer, showed us round the mechanical equipment of his farm. With it, he and his mother alone are running a 250-acre holding. And that, I believe, is one of the reasons of that high productivity yield which Monsieur Renault quoted. Very encouraging, I find it. And now, this is John Connell, signing off in London. John Connell was speaking in the series London Letter.